the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou katoa. I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan and we will analyse New Zealand's national security strategy and what must be considered so as to position New Zealand, Aotearoa, as a secure and progressive independent Pacific Island state in this 2020 decade. There's a lot to catch up on here. For example, there has been no defence white paper since the John Key-led national governments in the 2010 through to 2017 period. There has been no, for example, no comprehensive review of New Zealand's strategic priorities, nor an assessment of the region's threat landscape, both internally and externally. And remember, we have seen significant terrorist threats and also cyber attacks and ransomware type of attacks that have been building up in their severity and with their significant targets. But what changes can we expect to see with regard to New Zealand's defence forces, the intelligence community and cyber defence agencies? Then at part halfway through the program today, we'll also look at major events around the world, and we will discuss the latest recent rounds of elections in places like Peru, Mexico, and what's taking shape in Israel. And Paul has a theory that what's taking place in these most troubled regions can be viewed as a referenda on neoliberalism and national populism. Does this mean neoliberalism, for example, has run its course? Okay, so let's cross to Paul, who is waiting online to discuss these issues and more. Good afternoon, Paul.
Oh, tēnā koe and kia ora, Selwyn. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Paul. So let's start with the New Zealand part of the program. The National Security Strategy. Now, this is something that is going to be taking form in the next few weeks, as I understand. And can you take us through this and what's the backdrop to it from the point of view of the need and also where it may track, Paul?
Yeah, actually, this is a good follow-on to our discussion last week about whether or not New Zealand is shouldering its weight when it comes to the ANZUS Alliance, or what used to be the ANZUS Alliance, on defense and security matters. And I'm going down in a couple of weeks down to Wellington to be part of a working group that is going to formulate the outlines of a new national security strategy. Notice I say security, not just defense. Yes. And that's an important thing to keep in mind because the nature of threats and whatnot has evolved considerably. So let me just give a little bit of background here, particularly to our international viewers who may not understand, although you phrased it very well, what it's like to be a small island country, liberal democratic to boot, in a world of bigger powers, in a world that's in transition, as many of our viewers will know. And so here's the backdrop to this, or the context. In a weird way, New Zealand has enjoyed the benefits of what is known as the tyranny of distance. Normally, when you think of the tyranny of distance, you think of the negative side, which is the cost of imported goods is greater because the distances between the supplier nations is greater than in most instances. Again, we have no land borders with anybody. We're 2,000 kilometers away from the nearest independent state. And so normally that was considered to be a negative thing to be overcome. On the other hand, in the security field, it was always an advantage because New Zealand's very difficult to overrun. You've got to come by sea. I guess New Zealand could get bombed, but you're going to find it hard to get here and occupy territory. And so although the Japanese did come down and the Germans, in fact, ran subs off New Zealand coast.
Yeah.
The real fact of the matter is, as Helen Clark said, we traditionally have been in a pretty benign strategic environment. Well, things have changed. They didn't just change with 9/11. They've changed because of technology. I mean, the whole idea of cyber warfare means that our borders mean nothing when it comes to hostile interests trying to weaken our internal defenses. And then, of course, we not only had the 9/11 sequels, but then we had the March 15, 2019 terrorist attack committed by a white supremacist on domestic soil, with the largest loss of life in a terrorist event in New Zealand's history. All in the context of great power competition, Middle Eastern conflicts to which New Zealand contributed, Afghanistan, of course, and again, this whole cyber domain, which has now become one of the central battle places. So the idea here is we haven't had, as you said, a defense white paper since the Key government, which ended in 2017. Why? There's been a series of crises. We've had that terrorist attack. We have had the volcano explosion on White Island. And we have had the pandemic. And so security agencies have been dealing with those things, and they haven't had the time to pause and reflect about the nature of their mission.
If we're looking at cybersecurity as well, I mean, we've had the New Zealand Stock Exchange, NZX, under a significant attack last year. We've had Waikato DHB, which is a public hospital in the Waikato province or region of New Zealand, where its entire IT platform was taken out. All patient records, their private details, the efficient functioning of those public hospitals that all feed into that district health board, all gone and into the hands of those who were demanding a ransom. Paul, you know, without digging down into a trench on this, my general understanding is that the New Zealand GCSB had positioned to protect essential infrastructure from such attacks. So this national security strategy is one which is obviously overdue, and that context that you gave explains why it's overdue, not necessarily negligence, but certainly from the point of view of catch-up, we're in that space in 2021, aren't we?
And in fact, I was lucky enough to see the briefing notes delivered to the incoming Minister of Defence in 2020, after the elections last year, and they're pretty comprehensive, and they'll be the basis, I think, for defense's response to the call for a national security strategy. They may issue a white paper down the road, but I think this is going to lead them into these discussions about a holistic approach rather than compartmentalize national security into external and internal.
Can you explain that, the holistic approach?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So traditionally, when you think of security, you think of external defense, which is the purview of the military, and internal defense, which is the purview of the police. The intelligence services break both ways, but usually are compartmentalized or siloed, as is known in the jargon. And what's happened is the nature of the threats have evolved, have morphed, and now what we have is neither international or domestic threats, although those do exist in their separate categories, but we have what are known as intermestic or glocal threats. There's threats that may emanate abroad, but which have specific domestic ramifications and manifestations. Or our domestic threats may evolve to such a point as they become matters of international concern. And the foremost area of that is cyber warfare. Cyber warfare, not only talking about the hacking, and I'll say something about that in a second, but the dissemination of radical ideologies by the internet so that you can have white supremacists self-radicalized in the privacy of their own homes, who then go out and commit acts of mass violence egged on by people who are thousands of miles away. This is a whole new threat landscape. So traditionally, and I'll make this really quick, New Zealand is actually a bit of a contradiction. We are a maritime country by default.
So you're talking traditional defense here. Yeah.
traditional defense, because, you know, we still have traditional defense needs. But to make it really quick, by geographic circumstance, New Zealand is a maritime country. The irony is that we are an army territorial, army-centric military.
Is there that because of our interest in multilateralism and peacekeeping, etc.?
Yes, I would argue in modern times, indeed. Remember, we've carried over the legacy of two post-colonial wars where we sent thousands of our young men to die on the behest of our colonial master. And so we've had large armies before. But the thing here is that New Zealand's total uniformed defense forces are slightly less than 10,000 personnel, of which slightly less than 5,000 are in the army. The Air Force has about 2,800 people. And remember, we have no fighter wing. It's a complete transport and carrier, cargo-carrying Air Force, logistics, if you will. And then we have a 2,050 personnel Navy. This, for a maritime country, we only have two frigates. We only have two transport vessels. We have a fair amount of inshore patrol vessels, but we can't man them.
How does the Air Force compare in that space?
Well, by all rights, if you look at conventional militaries around the world, if they are not territorial, they're not land-based militaries, the Navy is the first amongst equals and would be the largest force. Case in point, even though it does have a large landmass, is Chile. They have a formidable Navy, you know, something on the order of 40 boats, most of which are fighting boats. And they don't kid around. I mean, when it comes
expensive hardware too, isn't it?
Obviously enough, the Navy is the most expensive of the military forces. The Chileans have the advantage that they have copper revenues, something on the order of 10% of all copper revenues pre-tax go into the Chilean military. That's an authoritarian legacy from the Pinochet era, which is just about, has been reviewed and may in fact be changed under this new constitutional review coming up later this year. But what I mean to say here is that most maritime countries put a premium on their navies because they're protecting the sea lines of communication. They're protecting their exclusive economic zones. Remember, if we extend 200 kilometers in any direction from New Zealand, all that water is supposedly ours for exclusive economic exploitation. And let me just say that we don't have the resources to defend all of that maritime territory, and other actors know that. And so New Zealand's in a bit of a predicament in that we do have this large army-centric army component, and it is designed to not only engage in territorial defense at home, that's its main purpose, which it hasn't had to do pretty much ever, but also to go in coalition arrangements and mainly do peacekeeping operations, civil assistance, search and rescue, you know, all the sort of non-lethal aspects.
The rebuilding, rebuilding infrastructure when cyclones, hurricanes hit this part of the world, that type of effort. So what I'm picking up from your explanations there is you will see a realignment, you expect to see a realignment, or that is the challenge for New Zealand government to advance more resource, more buck, if you like, going into the naval exercises, naval issues, naval hardware and logistics with the Air Force, and less emphasis on the actual land-based territorial but also New Zealand Army areas. Sorry, I just blurred that last part a little bit. But is that correct, Paul? You would see a realignment that would match perhaps New Zealand's presence and where it is tracking politically as an independent Pacific Island state in this 2020 decade?
Yeah, I mean, it's a subject that comes up periodically for discussion every time a white paper is about to be drafted. And the Army's been able to beat back efforts to reduce it in size and increase the size of the Navy and the Air Force. Now, I think that the political equation, and again, you've rightly pointed that out, favors a discussion about whether New Zealand's to start shifting towards a more maritime orientation. We don't need the fighter wing. although the Australians complain a lot about that. We do need a strong aerial logistical wing, and as we discussed last week, we're in the process of doing exactly that with some of the new equipment purchases. New Zealand has a very strong combat engineer and medic corps. And one might argue that if you look at the army, it actually has more of those type of people than it has so-called warriors, tip of the spear types. We have a 300 person SAS who are definitely the sharp end of the spear, and they absorb a lot of resources because of their specialized training. But you know, we don't have any armor. We have an artillery brigade. I mean, that, you know, that doesn't do anything when you go overseas. And so we really need to think through, what is this army, what is its purpose? And I certainly have no qualms about keeping the special forces element, because you get a lot of bang out of the buck with those guys. But the rest of the military, which is essentially a large infantry division, you know, a division being about 8,000 people, it's essentially a variation of that. And so it'd be good, particularly since this government has been pretty forward-leaning when it comes to engaging a strategic vision, as to whether or not, you know, the Army could lose a few thousand personnel and they could be put into boats or airplanes.
Yeah.
Now, I will say this as a last thing. The one problem, Selwyn, and you know this as well as I do, is we're incredibly lucky people to be living in New Zealand, because quite frankly, our youth don't want to go into the military. There's enough employment. There's you know, plenty of things to do in peacetime. And so, unlike many other countries, our youth is not interested, and we don't have that sort of war culture that places like the United States have. So this idea of going into the military as a patriotic act and this sort of thing, that simply doesn't exist. So, now, admittedly, Maori are overly represented within the ranks, and there is a warrior culture within Maoridom has served brilliantly in our military forces. So there is that. It's sort of like
Going
Americans.
Back to the Maori battalion, the Maori battalion, and World War II in particular, created a whole culture of something that's revered even today.
Yeah, and there's an intergenerational passing of the torch. It reminds me of Deep South military people. When I was involved with the U.S. military, you constantly run into these Southern guys whose fathers served, whose grandfathers served, and went all the way back, I hate to say it, to the Confederacy. Wow. And they just had this tradition of
different
service.
But the intergenerational is something that you're seeing in evidence here. Sorry, Pope, before we go into the second part of the program, can you just take us through the cybersecurity elements, the New Zealand intelligence community elements? What do you expect to see in a national security strategy with respect to that? And also, what can the New Zealand public, the Aotearoa New Zealand public, expect to see? Is there going to be an invasion more of civil liberties, for example, or is this more external kind of considerations and equipping New Zealand to be able to fight off cyber attacks like we've seen these tests against essential infrastructure in the last 9 months?
Well, okay, so, you know, we've just finished discussion of the traditional military side of things. We'll see where that goes, but the new form of warfare is what is known as hybrid warfare, of which cyber warfare is one component. We're going into machine learning, we're going into artificial intelligence. There's many different manifestations of hybridity when it comes to warfare, one of which is the cyber hacking. Now, let's be very clear. There are many ways to engage in cyber hacking. It could be state-sponsored, criminal. But at least in the case of the Russians, what appears to be the case is that Russian intelligence says to criminal organizations, we will allow you to conduct your business and you can keep the profits from your business, but you need to share the tricks of the trade with us, with Russian intelligence. So if you want to hack a power grid in some country, if you want to shut down gas pipelines in the United States, go ahead.
Or Estonia's a power grid some years ago now.
Yeah, and the idea here is that if you can weaken the enemy from within, if you can weaken him from behind the front lines, that's cost effective. You know, you're debilitating him before you have to engage him in the kinetic field. And so some actors are hybrid themselves. They're a mix of state actors and criminal organizations, each serving each other's purposes for mutual benefit, but each with a very distinctive objective in mind. The criminals want to make money. The Russian state, and there's arguments that other states have gotten involved, are interested in geopolitical advantage. And so what we've seen in New Zealand is a serious test of our signals intelligence defenses. And here's the interesting thing. You mentioned privacy. Well, this has really helped the signals intelligence guys. Why? Because New Zealand has been extremely slow to understand the threat of cyber crime and cyber warfare. We've heard time and time again that New Zealand is the Achilles heel of the Five Eyes network, not because the government agencies are lazy, but it's been very difficult to convince New Zealand, because of the tyranny of distance, that anyone would be interested in us enough to try to take down a power grid, steal patient files, those that sort of thing. And so these external actors, because this is coming from abroad, are now going to do more to convince the New Zealand public that some of their privacy rights have to be compromised in order to defend against this sort of attack. Remember, the attack on the Waikato District Health Board stole confidential people's health records, encrypted it, and then put it in a cloud that the authorities don't know where it exists or aren't sure. Yeah. And so, you know, ransom has been demanded. The American Pipeline Company paid ransom in Bitcoin in order to get the pipes flowing again. This is going to alert the public here in New Zealand to what the signals intelligence guys have been saying for almost 15 years now, which is this is the new form of warfare. It's a mixture of criminality and statecraft. And we need, and let's be clear.
That point, you know, my understanding of this is that's exactly right. And a couple of years ago, I sat down with a one-on-one with Eugene Kaspersky, who created Kaspersky Labs, for example. And he put it exactly in that way, that there is a hybrid between, like, with respect to the Russian Federation, or the FSB and their cyber teams, and also out there hired for contract, if you like. And the merging of the two is pretty much to be viewed as one. It's an interesting kind of thing. And the tyranny of distance element is a thing of the past, clearly. As soon as you've got a fiber cable that's connected, you're as connected as downtown New York to anything else. So it's an interesting thing. Look, Paul, at this juncture, if you like, I'll just address a few of the comments that have come in just on that point. Then we'll go straight to discussing Peru and the other countries that are coming into scope. Sure. Remember, that question is neoliberalism on its way out? Has it run its course in some of these elections that are going on around the place? A bit of a test of that, a referenda, if you like, on what's then. But let's come back in a couple of moments. Okay. Paul, we've got some comments that have come in. It's probably a good time just to bring those in. So a couple of them are slightly off topic here, but we'll bring them in anyway. What we've got here is Kevin Hester. I'd like Paul's views on John Pilger's documentary, The Coming War on China. Maybe, Paul, we'll pick up on that that point at another stage. And we've also got Craig Burns, and he says that he... having lived in Australia for 30 years, this right-wing extremist views are hell-bent on picking a war with China. You can see China is very much in the minds of people with respect to New Zealand's national security strategy. He's also saying that in his view, remember Craig Burns is coming from Australia on these comments, he says New Zealand is right to distance itself from Australia. And he goes on with other comments there to give reasons why he believes that's the case, and mainly because of what he perceives as extreme right-wing media dominating the narrative in Australia. We've also got other comments that are coming in relating to employment and exactly why I think we should have an ACF. Now, that's coming from Facebook with Sam there. Craig Burns, once again, he's made a comment here. One observation after working many years in Australia is living in this culture, there is deep-seated hatred of New Zealand and the Australian Liberal Party. That's an interesting take. Then he goes on and he justifies his comments by giving some examples of that. We'll move on, though. The New Zealanders, he is saying, and this is someone who's living there, he's saying, and remember, is at the end, perhaps, of a steamroller impact coming from some of the more mainstream right-leaning media over there. And he's saying New Zealanders need to be warned of the Australian Liberal Party. So, Paul, those are all obviously comments that are coming in with great interest to our audience and listeners there. So we'll just take that off screen.
Let me just say to Craig, maybe as part of the strategic review, we need to think about our distance from Australia. You know, do we need to follow in their footsteps all the time? I mean, we don't nominally, because we do believe ourselves to be independent. But the pressures for us to follow Australia's lead in foreign policy and defense are enormous, because they find an echo chamber in places like the US and the UK. And so treading that line is going to be difficult. I personally believe that China is increasingly behaving like a rogue actor on the international stage. I don't think it has the capability to project force in the measure that even its leadership may think it can. And they could well get burned if they pick a fight with the wrong actor, even if the other actor is small. I mean, Taiwan has a version of what is known as the hedgehog defense. They're going to dig in. And they're going to have to be dug out, and that's not going to be an easy feat, especially if the United States, Australia, and other countries come to the Taiwanese, if not rescue, their defense. So I don't see China as being the overwhelming threat that it is made out to be, although I do believe it is a rogue actor. But New Zealand's got to think about, again, this holistic approach. What are our proximate threats? What are our probable threats? What are our immediate threats? Do they emanate from abroad or at home, or is it a mixture thereof? All those things are going to have to go into the mix, and certainly our relationship with Australia will impinge on all of that. But you know what, Selin? We've been talking, security is a core function of the state. And the state, among other things, showed itself to be absolutely crucial to the pandemic mitigation strategy that was so successful here in New Zealand, which included military participation in the quarantine regime. And so I think that we need to think that the state is being brought back in the post-pandemic environment in a way that we hadn't seen in the previous 30 years, because the previous 30 years were dominated by market-driven ideologies and logics. And the elections in Latin America and elsewhere are a clear test of whether those market-driven ideologies are still viable today. So let's turn and talk about these recent elections in South America and Mexico.
And before we just make that transition to that discussion, just for our overseas audiences that may not be privy to what has been happening in Australia and New Zealand, is in Australia in particular, some of the mainstream media outlets have been absolutely hammering the public sphere discourse or injecting into that whole discussion of an element where they're claiming New Zealand has cozied up to China's interests and it's bowing away from respecting its natural ally, which is Australia. This, of course, is absolute rubbish. And this is where the comments are generating from, that people coming through here making comments are definitely sifting through all of that nonsense, and they've got their strong views on it. Just before we do, with a couple of comments here, well, one comment here I'll just bring up because it's very specific to the national security. Now, Liz, who's coming through from Facebook, is saying, it's disturbing that the real risks we face to our security such as cybersecurity, aren't being faced. And meanwhile, the New Zealand Defence Force invests in planes such as Poseidons, which can only be operated using US technology, and operators' so-called interoperability means we are not independent. So that's another view that is coming through from the audience today. That once again, what that's reflecting in my view there, and Liz, I hope this is accepted by you there, is a strong feeling of support for New Zealand to embark on an independent bent here, an independent foreign policy, independent defence policy, all of those interacting. So, Paul, should we go and we'll come back from this transition?
Yeah, let me answer Liz, just out of respect to her question. Liz, until New Zealand develops a defense industry or a military weapons industry that can produce airplanes and boats, we're going to have to rely on others for platforms like the P-8. The P-8 is made by Boeing. The P-3 that it replaces, as well as the C-130s that are also being replaced by more modern copies, those are made by Lockheed Martin. So we've been using American equipment for a long time, as many other countries do. That does not necessarily impinge on our independence and foreign policy. It's just a weapon system. We can debate whether or not it's good or bad. These P-3, P-8s, they originated as anti-submarine warfare planes. They're used in that capacity. Think about it. If we've got foreign submarines spooking around our exclusive economic zone, these are the planes that can pick up on them and send patrol boats out to intercept them. I mean, there's uses. They're also used for search and rescue, very effective for search and rescue. So the origin of the platform does not necessarily mean that our independence as a state is compromised. And I will say, because I knew something about it, the bidding for the replacement for the P-3 included the Brazilian aircraft manufacturer Embraer. So there was competitiveness layered into the process. So I'm not as concerned about where the platform originated. What I am concerned about is how it's going to be used.
Yeah, fair comment. Okay, we'll come back after this transition. We'll be discussing Peru elections. We'll be discussing the situation in Mexico, Israel, and also putting the question, is neoliberalism run its course? We'll be back in a moment. Yeah, welcome back. Now, what we're going to do here is just play a beginning clip that is coming through from France 24. Now, this is overnight New Zealand time, and then we'll pick up on the most latest with respect to Peru. But let's just kick this off.
Well, for more, let's cross to Thomas Nicolon. Thomas, we heard there Keiko Fujimori speaking late Sunday. This was when she had a much wider lead. What's the latest?
Votes are still being counted by the Electoral Commission in Peru. Keiko Fujimori is still ahead for now, but her lead is clearly narrowing. It has been narrowing for the past few hours. It's very hard to predict what things are going to look like when all the votes are counted, even though about 94% of the votes have been counted already. The margin is so thin that things could still go either way. And the vote that must still be counted are votes from rural areas and from the Amazon, and these areas tend to favor Pedro Castillo, so things could possibly go that way in the next few hours. But
and indeed it seems like it has, Paul. You know, as the count got further on, it does seem, doesn't it, that there is an election turnaround, if you like, where Castillo, it looks like he may have actually pulled this off. What's your take on it all, Paul?
Well, there's about 300,000 votes left to be counted, and already Keiko Fujimori is yelling voter fraud. She's taking a page out of the Trump book, and even before the election count is finished, she's saying it was stolen. So she knows the outcome. What's interesting about this is two things. Just, again, for those who may not know, the Fujimoris, that is the father who is now in jail, for human rights abuses during his tenure as president. And the daughter are part of what are known as the Nisei community in Peru, that is the Japanese-Peruvian community. Nisei communities are very powerful lobbying groups in places like Peru and Brazil. Brazil has a very large Nisei community. And even though Peru has the aspects of apartheid South Africa, in the sense that whites are a minority who absolutely rule in Peru, and indigenous people are the majority and have relatively little power, Nisei Peruvians are honorary whites. So Japanese Peruvians are part of the white elite. And Keiko Fujimori represents their interests, which again are heavily skewed in their favor. I mean, the mining industry, which Peru depends on, it's the third biggest producer of copper in the world. All of those revenues and whatnot are accrued disproportionately by the urban elites in Lima in particular. And so Pedro Castillo represents the long-held grievances of the majority of indigenous people. And he is a socialist. So Fujimori is saying that Peru is going to go to hell in a handbasket if this socialist gets elected.
We've heard that before, haven't we?
We've heard that before, and it's good to pick up on. Because what is the mantra of the right and the elites every time a social democrat or a socialist comes close to power in Latin America? Oh, it's the second coming of Che Guevara. Oh, it's Fidel Castro all over again. Oh, you know, our way of life is going to die. Well, you know, maybe if they actually shared some of the riches of their country instead of hoarding it, they wouldn't get themselves in such a predicament, to say nothing of the miserable governance that Peru has suffered now for well over a decade. But what's interesting about this, beyond the Nisei connection, which also exists in Brazil under Bolsonaro, is that this is the second or third wave of what is known as the pink tide. That is the move, the electoral move to the left.
Yeah, this is interesting. So what you're shaping up there is this test, this referendum, if you like, of opposing ideologies. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah. So Latin America and South America in particular were under the old Chicago boys and under the dictatorships of the 70s and 80s, were the first to adopt neoliberal, market-driven macroeconomic policies. They privatized. They basically dismantled the welfare states that had existed previously. And those models were adopted by other parts of the world, but South America were the first, again, under dictatorial circumstances. Well, by the 1990s, it was clear to South Americans that neoliberalism benefited a few and hurt the many. That yes, in the initial years, there were some good reforms that injected efficiencies into national economies. But over time, elites took advantage of the turn towards market economics and basically appropriated wealth for themselves at the expense of everybody else. And income inequalities increased. All those sort of macroeconomic indicators showed that the experiment was not as good as its champions in Washington and London said it was. By the late 90s, we had the first wave of the so-called pink tide. The leader of that was Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. So Chavismo, the Bolivarian Revolution. But remember, Lula in Brazil came in. We had socialist governments in Chile. We had the Peronist governments in Argentina. We had in Uruguay a 20-year socialist coalition that included former guerrillas ruling that country. So there was a massive shift to the left.
And of course, that was countered, wasn't it, very persuasively by the right?
Well, yes, within a decade. At first, this leftist swing was met by a lot of progressives with much enthusiasm. But two things happened, three. The one universal constant was that the right side of the political ledger engaged in increasingly disloyal opposition. They just opposed things for the sake of opposing, and by and large, they got the support of Washington in their opposition to anything the leftists tried to do. And that didn't matter if it was a populist left like Chavez, or it was a truly democratic left like the Uruguayans under the Frente Amplio, or the Chileans under the Socialist Coalition. These were genuinely democratic governments. But therein lies the rub. Most of the democratic governments eventually were replaced by right-wing governments in fair and competitive elections because they didn't deliver on what they promised, and that had a lot to do with the obstructionism of Congresses dominated by right-wing interests.
The cycle has actually started to swing decisively through the whole South American continent, do you feel? Or is it located to?
Yeah, but with a twist. The second option was, back then, was to get increasingly dictatorial. And so Chavez got more authoritarian. His successor, Maduro, now runs a kleptocracy. And there's an old-fashioned leftist authoritarian still around who isn't a Castro, and that's Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, a former Sandinista leader. They're about to have elections, and he's arresting his opponents. He's taking a page out of the Belarusian playbook, and he's arresting his political competition before the election. So, you know, there's an unpleasant left out there. But we are coming full cycle, except the twist is this. It's not just social democrats and socialists who are coming back to the fore. It's national populists. Yeah. And here's where I think we see the death of neoliberalism.
Yeah. Can you talk us through that? So we've gone through the cause. We're starting to move into a new cycle. What do you see as the tipping point which has caused this? And what is it going to look like in 12 months from now?
Okay, it's hard to foresee the future, but let's look at why neoliberalism is dead. Neoliberalism, and again, I'm a Chicago grad, was forced to take the macro-micro sequence over in economics in order to satisfy my PhD supervisors. That was when Milton Friedman was still around. Neoliberal economics basically says that finance capital should dictate where a country's productive apparatus goes, where investment should flow, where that country is located in the global system of production. So you let finance capitalists, you give them free rein, and they'll put money into the most efficient sectors of the economy. And that indeed did happen in many places early on. But what the economists couldn't foresee is how capitalists in practice will actually behave. And so they got into monopolization, they got into pathological behavior. And that's what brought about the resistance from the left. It gave life to the left in a measure they could have never foreseen, simply because, again, the wealth was not distributed, even in a trickle-down way.
Yeah, I was going to say that in a trickle-down way, and also from a point of view of interventionism. We've seen in the COVID pandemic the necessity perhaps to embrace more Keynesian economics kind of approach to such things, domestic economies, very much more a state moving to impose upon the population strict restrictions that are in the public good, in the public interest, the national interest of various countries. We've seen it very persuasively here in New Zealand, certainly in various states in Australia have followed in the same way. I'd say followed with a bit of a smile there. But with respect to Peru, and you're looking there, what do you see specifically is going to replace from the neoliberalism economic frameworks, if you like, and also from the point of view of what can really address some of the main, and I'll just bring it up on screen here, some of the main big issues that Peru is facing. For example, Keith Rankin, a New Zealand-based, Auckland-based economist and economic historian, has written on the Evening Report here, and I'll just go down to his graph that was published last night where he has crunched the numbers. And this is here, he is saying, before I bring it up, Keith writes, finally, we need to note that of countries of which good death statistics are available, and he's honing in and saying that Peru has been under the COVID grip, but it has been very, very effective in putting its data out to the World Health Organization and the global data crunching kind of organizations as well, so that it can be seen as a true reality, and other countries aren't. But he is saying here that it is by far the worst country in the world, considering that caveat, has been Peru. And here, for example, is the graph that Keith has put together, where you can see Peru right up the top there as we go through March through to June 2020. That red line right up above other countries is its death rate in excess of the death rates or the mortality rates that you would expect in normal conditions, which is right down on that zero line. So there, why I bring that up, Paul, is that Peru has some huge issues domestically to overcome, largely around the COVID experience that it is in the grip of, but also from the point of positioning its sustaining economy and its longevity relating to getting back to perhaps where it once was. What do you see is that if there is, and it's proven by the final vote counts, a change of government, what do you see that contributing to the challenges that Peru must overcome?
Well, just like I said before, that we must bring the state back into the equation in any post-pandemic society. What you see in Peru and elsewhere is what happens when the rush to privatizing public services leads to negative outcomes. Peru went from being a very healthy public health system to a system that was intensely privatized. And if you look across the globe, the more health systems were privatized, the worse the response to the pandemic. Not only was there vaccination inequalities, so that poorer sectors of society are not vaccinated, and the rich hoard vaccines, and that is the case in Peru. But you had a maldistribution of resources nationwide because it was a decentralized system of private operators competing with the public sector, and a weak state that could not compel the private operators to behave in the common interest. They behaved in the interest of their investors and their clients. And so Peru suffers from this syndrome. Several other countries do. Brazil is increasingly, or has been increasingly, privatized under Bolsonaro, of all people, and now the pandemic has hit them as well. And so one of the things that is occurring is that people are beginning to appreciate that in some central public roles, health, welfare, defense, and security, the state should have never been privatized. It should never have been reduced. It could be made more efficient. But the rush to turn everything into a market instrument was, in fact, mistaken.
So the trend towards small government, it's gone. There's a recognition amongst the populations that government is there as an instrument of the people. Now, in an ideal situation, that would be thing. So, do you think, for example, with neoliberalism on the out, tracking away from the point of view of pragmatic politics requiring intervention in a new way, do you see that that is going to sustain countries like Peru and many others in the Latin American kind of experience, South American experience, to a better medium-term future?
Yeah, I do. I mean, let's be clear once again, the move to national populism, be it Trump, be it Bolsonaro, be it Erdogan in Turkey, is a repudiation of neoliberalism as well. You don't have to be a socialist to repudiate the market-oriented directives, which have led to the bad response to the pandemic in many, many countries. So I think as a macroeconomic model, as a social ideology, we're seeing the end of neoliberalism. Unfortunately, what's emerging is not just a re-strengthening of the state and its proper function as macroeconomic manager and provider of public goods. We're seeing these sort of authoritarian statists. Trump, again, was one of them, who are economic nationalists, who are demagogues, that sort of thing. And they can be from the left or the right. And unfortunately, they're going to be here for some time to go, some time to continue. Although Bolsonaro's up for election in October, and it looks increasingly clear that he's going to lose if he isn't impeached before then. And his old rival, his old nemesis, Lula, will come back to be president yet again. But I think the key point here is that, well, it was well said. I read an interview by someone who was a supporter of Castillo in Peru. And she said, I think, something that the elites in South America and elsewhere need to understand fully. She said, if he is not elected fairly, the way it seems to be going, if this election is taken away from him by Fujimori and the elites, her phrase was, there will be social conflict. What she means is revolution. You see, you can be a socialist, but something known as the structural dependence of the state on capital means that the state, the country, will remain capitalist. A socialist president can modify things around the edges via taxation. Castillo, for example, wants to increase tax rates on the mining firms and distribute that through health and welfare. But they can't touch the essential. Peru is a capitalist state. New Zealand is a capitalist state. We can have labor governments. We can have socialist governments. But they're not going to touch the core. Why? Because the resistance from capitalists will be ferocious, and they have the support of places like the United States and the European Union. So absent a violent grassroots mass display of collective violence that not only overthrows the old regime, but engages in what is known as parametric change of the socioeconomic framework, what you get is basically reform mongering. A socialist comes in, tinkers around the margins, tries to humanize the productive apparatus, and if it goes well, might get reelected. If they stymie Castillo, if it turns out when Lula comes back, they somehow try to prevent him from assuming office, and it's assumed that he will win, then you have the makings of grievances that transcend the political and economic system and will only be resolved by collective violence. And you don't want to go there, because the one thing we can be sure about is revolutions may or may not succeed with their original objectives of making for fairer societies, but they inevitably result in authoritarian regimes of one type or another. So the one thing we can be sure of is if a violent groundswell of revolutionary activity occurs in the wake of a stolen election, democracy will be as finished as neoliberalism is.
All right. Thank you for that. Just before we do go, Paul, I will just bring in a couple of comments that have come through since halfway through the program. Certainly, the audience has been very active with respect to our first discussion on national security, and obviously with respect to Australia-New Zealand relationships. I've just brought up on screen Robert Miles, where he's countering the view that came through from Liz in a sense, and it's quite a long comment. I'd encourage people to go onto Facebook to actually read the interactions, because there's a good discussion going on there. Sam added, and I brought it in when we were talking about it, that Alan Greenspan admitted that the neoliberalism model is wrong. That can take a whole episode to unpack that. Which would be an interesting one for sure. Robert Miles again is talking there, and once he's going right into the detail of some of the historical elements relating to military manoeuvres, etc., etc. And I'd encourage people to go onto Facebook and follow through that discussion and perhaps interact themselves. Thank you, Paul, for your commentary today, and also from the point of view your analysis as well and your company. And we look forward to inviting people back again this time next week. So we kick off around Thursday New Zealand time at midday, which is United States daylight saving time on the eastern border of the United States at around 8 p.m. We look forward to presenting some of the big events that are going to be tracking in the next 7 days, and we'll give an analysis of the same. Until that time, thank you for your company. We look forward to it again next week. Goodbye.